Mark Maron. It's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
Blah, 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 blah.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians. Good morning, vegetarians. Good morning to all of you people out there who are feeling okay on Tuesday. I didn't start off that good today, Mark.
Why not?
Riley. Why not? Well, what,
why not?
First of all,
it's Black History Month, man. I'm going to think you're prejudiced.
Oh, okay. You're right. I feel better. I feel better
there
now.
There you go. Approach the month with a positive attitude. Right, I know I am.
All right. Well, here, maybe this is weirdly connected. I don't know. I woke up last night. I cooked black-eyed peas and collard greens.
Whoa.
All right.
Whoa, that doesn't count. That was January 31st.
Okay, no, but here's the deal. Here's the deal is that this morning, I made him vegetarian, too. Know me, because I'm starting this new thing. I haven't quite decided how I'm going to approach this vegetarian thing. I haven't decided whether or not I'm going to, ease into it and still eat some fish. You know,
go ahead, eat the fish.
I talked to Jim Murrow. Like I'm willing to let go of that.
He's going
to
convert you.
He was on the air yesterday. You heard him. I talked about no meat, no pork. No, I'm not going to do any more of that because I had a bad grizzle problem. I had a grizzle problem the other night when I was eating the hamburger. I found something in the hamburger. I'm like, wow, man. You know
what? What did you find?
Well, you know, dude, when you're eating meat, and one day you realize it just hits you in the head, like, oh my god, I'm eating meat, and this is a part that I shouldn't be eating. It's a cow, and whatever. It doesn't make any difference. It's going to be better for me. So I cooked the collard greens. I cooked my black-eyed peas in my crock pot. And this morning I'm packing it up. Dude, you know when your life just becomes a comedy of errors and you just like there's that moment like I woke up pissed off because I woke up at 1:30 in the morning. I couldn't get back to sleep. I don't know what I was doing.
I did too.
Yeah, I was festering. I was just sitting there going, how come my life is, whatever it is. It's my wife, if it's my my own disappointment, whatever. But I couldn't get back to sleep. Then I get up. I'm like, fine, I'll get up. And the three monsters were sitting there waiting for me to feed them. And then I go in the room and I'm packing up my lunch and I pack it into one of those little plastic containers that you get at IKEA. Now the IKEA containers, like I can't believe I'm going to get this specific and noodle on about this, but they press down. You got to press them down into the top, right? So I fill the thing up with the beans and the collard greens and I'm pressing the thing down into the top and it goes right through. I press too hard and it pops and like 5 minutes before I got to leave the house, I have an explosion of beans on my hands. All right, they're all over the place and it's just one of those things. It was like a Lucy episode where I'm just covered in beans and I'm like, This is not how this is going to start today.
Well, right? You know what?
This is not how it's going to start.
This is the danger of global warming. It's that gas.
I don't think it's got. Yeah, it's the methane. No,
methane from the beans blew up your thing.
It was a pressure problem, and then it's like, you know, I really believe, dude, is that if you wake up with that tension, that anger, that hostility, that whatever forces out there. Whatever the cosmic forces are going to conspire against you until they make a fool out of you. Like, you know, I woke up pissed off and I'm like, this sucks. I'm over. I didn't even know why. But then the beans blow up. I'm standing there covered with food. And you got to say, okay, all right, I get it. All right, either I turn this stuff off now. You know what I mean? I get over whatever I'm angry about, or I'm going to be made a fool of all day. Because when you walk around with that kind of tension, you're going to run into things. You know, it's just going to be it's going to be a comedy of errors until you finally surrender and say, "All right, I'm an idiot. I'm an idiot, and I'm not mad at anything. I should be grateful to be alive for crying out loud."
You know that grateful to be alive thing only has limited shelf life. I walk around,
of course,
and I think to myself, gee, you know, it's not so bad. I'm working here. I'm doing what I love to do. I've been doing it for a long time. I'm hanging out with you. And then reality sets in. I have to go to bed before my daughter.
All right.
You know, I got to get up at an ungodly hour in the morning. And lately I've been like opening my door thinking like, is anybody out there waiting for me? Has anybody gotten my pattern down yet? I leave the house at the same time every morning. I walk to the car. Is somebody going to be waiting behind my car with a gun or something?
Well, why is that one there? I mean, who do you think would be waiting for you just out of curiosity?
Somebody who wants some money. Doesn't have to be anybody in particular.
They're going
to
come to suburban New Jersey and hide in the backyard.
Some of the big crimes that take place in suburban New Jersey happen between 2 and 5 in the morning.
All right.
Nobody else is out.
Because, like, I never get the paranoia. I don't get the paranoia of, like, you know, someone's going to rob me. But in my building, because it's so weird, and that woman next door died, and it's sort of haunted. Yeah. And then I smell
Has anybody moved in?
No, they don't know what they're doing in there. They got to redo the whole apartment. There was part of me that's like, maybe I should move in there, and just since it's like it's raw, I can actually, you know, do something with it.
Yeah.
You know, like, because I was thinking about doing something in my house, and that's me and Kayla.
Does your landlord kind of, I mean, does he spend any, he or she spend any money on improvements?
He's the worst. I got a leak in my, he's a Dominican dentist, which has, and that's not, I'm not judging the guy. But that's what he's
a Dominican dentist.
That's what he is. He's a Dominican dentist. Carlos is a Dominican dentist. He came here, he bought the building, right, and then he had to go back to dental school to become a dentist here, you know?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But, like, my friend Jody, who lives downstairs, said she had a problem with her oven when she moved in, and she called Carlos, and he's this little guy, but he spends, like, you know, when he's not working on people's teeth, he spends it all his time at the gym.
So he's, oh, okay, he's like, so he's muscle-bound.
He looks like a walking fist. He's like the walking Dominican fist, you know? And so he goes down to Jody's apartment and to look at her oven, and she opens the oven, and he opens it up, he's like, I know how to fix it. If it were a mouth, I could fix it. And then he's got these people. Oh, God, the supers in my building. We had this, like...
you got more than one?
Well, dude, for a while we had these mountain people, like these South American mountain people. I don't know where they came from, but neither one of them spoke English, and they almost had that sort of indigenous, South American indigenous person look.
Oh, wow.
You know, like
Ecuadorian, Peruvian, Bolivian?
Yeah, like Peruvian mountain Indians. And, something happened. You know, he used to drink, and he ended up running somebody over, and he...
Oh, you told me about
that. Yeah, he split
the
country. Now we have this huge guy. He doesn't speak English, but his wife does. Well, needless to say, no, he doesn't put any money into the building. Okay. And now he's putting his office in the building because he couldn't afford the rent where his office was. He didn't want to pay it anymore. So now there's going to be a dentist's office in my building.
Well, that's good if your teeth hurt, but... The bottom line is, you don't want to move into an apartment if the guy's not going to spend any money fixing it up.
Well, see, that's what
I'm
thinking.
Stay where you're at.
Well, the deal is like, you know, I'm thinking when my wife moves out here, either I get a new apartment or I stay in the apartment that I'm in at the rate I'm in, and I put a little money into it because he's not going to. And if I'm not willing to buy a place, why not put a little money in it?
Look, the places in New York cost $5 million zillion a month. Everything. I don't care what neighborhood. I saw a thing in Washington Heights. For those of you who don't know about Washington Heights in New York, Washington Heights is the upper part of Upper Manhattan.
Yeah.
$710,000 for a condo.
For a two-bedroom?
Yeah.
That's crazy. It's crazy. I mean, I'm living for under a grand out there in Astoria, Queens, and that Astoria, Queens is the melting pot of the world.
It is the most diverse borough, the most diverse county in America.
It's unbelievable, and I love it. It's just, I don't know. I'm trying to step up a little
bit. Eastern Europeans, mountain people from Peru, you name it, they got it.
The Ukrainians, the Greeks, the Pakistanis, the Dominicans, the Colombians, the Indians, and then there's the Indians that live in... we just read that article. Are they Indians from the Caribbean? From Ghana?
Guyana. Indo-Guyanese.
Yes.
Yes.
There are Indians
in... Oh, absolutely. Both in Guyana and in Trinidad. There are large numbers of Indians who were imported as indentured servants during the 19th century. And they are called Indo-Trinidadian or Indo-Guyanese. Called Douglas, but that's kind of like it's not a pejorative term, but it's sort of a term that Indians use to describe Indians who were born in the Caribbean.
I'm completely fascinated with them because I read an article about these people, and I know there's a community of them out there in Queens.
Richmond Hill.
Yeah, and I know they have their own cuisine, and I'm like, you know, my food brain's going like, man, I love Indian food, but that's got to be really trippy.
It's a mélange of it's like two different cultures that have been melded together. The whole idea of rotis, for example, rotis are an Indian dish. Actually, it's not a dish; it's like a gigantic stuffed burrito.
Yeah,
and it was a dish that started in India but has taken hold in the Caribbean. So that Trinidad Carnival's coming up, and rotis are a staple of Trinidad.
Okay. Well, we gotta go. Can we go?
Well,
don't they have one here?
You busy this weekend?
No.
Because it's this weekend.
It is?
Yeah.
Where do you go?
Next week, actually. You go to Trinidad, man.
Oh, we can't go to Trinidad. Don't they have one here?
No. Well, they do in September, yeah.
Okay.
They have one in September. Labor Day Carnival. But see, now, Trinidad's and Rio's and New Orleans, because it's all tied into religious ritual, they all happen at the same time.
Well, this stuff fascinates me. I want to get a food historian on here because... Did you know that like a lot of the African American diet, a lot of the black diet, the classic Southern food like collard greens, yams, black eyed peas, all this stuff actually came up from Africa.
That's absolutely.
And I didn't know about all that stuff, and I want to learn some more.
Oh, no, let me
about Black History, Mark Riley.
This is Black History.
I'll give, okay.
All right.
And, can we wait on it, though?
Yeah, we can wait on it.
All right, so we got, and don't take offense out there. We actually have to take a break, and I'm going to learn a little something about, because I know there's people out there, why doesn't he let the black man talk?
That's right. Well, I'm talking now. It's Black History Month. I'm talking for 28 days.
We're going to come back, talk about Howard Dean and how his race for DNC chairman is coming. We also have Donnie Fowler later in the show, and I'm going to learn a little something about Black History Month at 16 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Hello, this is Mick Foley, professional wrestler and best-selling author, and you're listening to the two guys who give the right wing the smackdown. It's Mark Maron and Mark Riley with Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Twenty past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. It's Tuesday. And I'm kicking, man. I'm all right. I think all that anger that fueled me this morning when I had the explosion of food helped me out. Helped me get started. And then Kalo, the Costco hoe, let me blast a song in my head. I got to do that every day, dude. I got to do that every morning. I just got to come down here a little early, put the headphones on, and blast something that makes my dopamine travel. You know what I mean? I think songs do that. If you play the right song that moves you deep down in your soul, it'll just sort of get those neurotransmitters circulating properly. So Howard Dean, if we could, Howard Dean is looks like he's going to be the guy for DNC chair. We've got another guy who's running for it, Donnie Fowler, who's going to be on later in the show to talk about his angle. But there was some resistance to Dean initially because of what they call his left-leaning views, and his passion and his commitment to the core values of the Democratic Party, as opposed to trying to pander to a non-existent middle. This is what makes Dean what he is, and this is why I think personally I'm going to endorse him myself, whether the network does or you do or anyone else does. I like the dude. This is what he said on our show a couple months ago.
Yeah.
This guy's got a genial smile and a nice way about him in public, and that's about it. He's the most incompetent chief executive we've had since Warren Harding.
Look at that.
Wow. But
he's willing to take a shot at the prez, and so many of these guys aren't willing to take, without being sort of, diplomatic and sort of like, cloying. Is that the right word? Maybe? I don't know. But, a lot of them are not willing to take a shot. Now, could you explain to me, Mark Riley, how do they choose a Democratic National Committee chair? Who's involved in that? And what exactly does the job entail?
All right. There are 447 members of the Democratic National Committee. Mm-hmm. They, in a final vote, choose who the chair will be.
Now, these committee members, are they state representatives? Are they people who are elected? Are they volunteers? How does that work?
Probably all of the above.
Right.
For example, the Association of State Democratic Chairs, who ended up endorsing Howard Dean yesterday, are, I forgot how many they are total, but they are one voting block within the 447 members of the party.
Are these the ones that backed Fowler initially and then pulled it?
No.
Okay.
The executive committee of the Association of State Democratic Chairs, a smaller subset of the association, did in fact decide to back Fowler.
Right.
But then the membership of the Association of State Democratic Chairs switched up on the executive committee and did not follow their recommendation. Now, the Association of State Democratic Chairs is the people from each state who chair the Democratic Party in that state. So, for example, here in New York, there's a guy named Herman Denny Farrell.
Yeah.
He is the state Democratic chair. He voted in all this. And what happened was, and this is, it's not unprecedented, but it is unusual for this association to buck what its executive committee recommends.
Right.
But it seems as though that Dean juggernaut that we've talked about a few times seems to be what was at play here. Now, the other people who are in the race, and Wellington Webb, the only African-American who was contesting, dropped out yesterday and endorsed Howard Dean.
Right.
Okay?
Yep.
But it seems as though the rest of them, including Donnie Fowler, including Martin Frost, including Tim Romer, David Leland, they all believe that until the vote is actually cast among the 447, which will take place February 12th, that it's still up for grabs, even though this is a very, very significant boost to Dean. And the fact that he won 56-21. So it wasn't close. It was almost like 3-1 almost.
Yeah. Now let me ask you. I'm new to this whole game in a lot of ways, and I don't. You know, it's clear the Democratic National Chair is in charge of fundraising,
and
reaching out,
and rulemaking. I mean, the Democratic
rulemaking in what sense?
Rulemaking in terms of the rules that are in place when you go to the convention, the rules from which the platform of the Democratic Party is drafted.
Right.
The chair, if not holding the bully pulpit, actually holds the reins of power to determine what rules apply within the party.
Right. And I guess some of the concern around Howard Dean is that they think that, congressional Democrats think that he's such an ideologue that he's going to, you know, be imposing on them. He's going to be calling them to the carpet too many times, that he's going to, you know, have demands that they may not want to compromise with.
Well, what I think they are rebelling against here is the idea that the chair of the DNC would call for some measure of discipline on their part in terms of pursuing Democratic Party objectives.
Right.
For example, and this is we'll get to why this is an important example.
Okay.
Suppose there are some Democrats in Congress who are prepared to give ground on the issue of same-sex marriage.
Right.
Now, whose job would it be to restate the party's position on same-sex marriage, whatever that may be? And I'm
the committee chair.
Committee chair would be the one that would say, hey, you know what, you guys are out of line. Now, under other circumstances, the chair of the Democratic National Committee could run people in primaries against people who got out of line on certain issues.
Right.
That's the stick that they hold in their hands.
Right, but it seems unlikely that would happen, given that, you know, we don't really have a lot of time for infighting here.
Well, I mean, Democratic primaries can be seen as infighting, or they can be seen as a healthy process by which you come, out of with a strong nominee for a particular.
Oh, that's
particular
true. Yeah, I was just thinking. Yeah, okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the flip side of it is, even if it's a Democrat in a strong district, if you run a primary opponent against that person, you make them spend their money.
And also, if the Democratic chair, it seems, has enough moxie and enough principle and stands behind the core values of the Democratic Party enough, that, you know, with his energy, he could, you know, in those primaries, he could make those values come to the surface. Like, he could run, if I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
So that's the power, is that they can make the candidate that best represents the party,
yeah,
you know, stand
yeah
out more than the one that doesn't.
And I'm going to tell you something else. Whoever the chair is, they're facing some extraordinary challenges in months and years ahead. We'll get to that a little bit when we come back, as well as, I believe, there's a liberal agenda, a few other things we got on tap.
Yes.
We'll get to all
Raymond
of them.
Should be here any second.
Any second here on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Why not a little Stones? That never hurt anybody when they were good. 34 past the hour. Air America Radio. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Yo.
Good morning, Memphis. Good morning, Memphis, Tennessee. WWTQ 680 AM, our newest affiliate. Yesterday we paid tribute to them by having all of our bumper music from Memphis.
From Memphis.
Today I think it's just From My Head or something. I don't know who made that choice, but Jumpin' Jack Flash. Man, when the Stones were good.
Dude.
All right. Here we go. Ramon just came in. I don't know. You know, I don't know if he's going to the Caribbean or what, or how long this bit's going to hold up. But he said he was wearing like a Hawaiian shirt and he had mouse ears on. I don't know what he's doing.
Well, he's either going to Orlando or Trinidad.
Yeah, Trinidad for the big parade. Here's George W. Bush's Palm Pilot for today, February 1st, 10 a.m. It's Black History Month. Ask Condi to round up some black people for photo op. Note, not Snoop Dogg or Michael Jackson. 11 a.m. Call Iyad Alawi. Tell him this is the time for unity in Iraq between your oil and our companies. Noon, call Tony Blair. Ask, how's Iran in April sound to you? Hello, 2 p.m. Talk to AARP officials. Say this: my father is really old, and you don't hear him whining about Social Security. Right, 3 p.m. Accuse Hillary Clinton of dirty politics. Say this: you won't faint your way into the White House, lady. 4 p.m., signed proclamation in honor of American Heart Month. Bring Chaney on stage for Peacemaker and Pacemaker photo op. There you go. That's the president's prompt pilot. So, as we were talking about, Howard Dean is looking like the front runner for the Democratic National Committee chairperson. Donnie Fowler is going to be on here in the third hour to talk about his candidacy for the same role, the same position. Now, a lot of the DNC chair has to do with reaching out. And what's happening in the world right now, in honor, you know, this is sort of an interesting topic for the first day of Black History Month, is that there is a consolidated effort on behalf of Republicans, behalf of the American Heritage Institute, and behalf of some of Gingrich's old cronies,
yes,
to put a program in place to lure Black voters to the side of the Republicans.
Yeah. Now, this is a very, very carefully crafted and constructed model that mm-hmm. they've built. The first thing people need to ask themselves is, why build a model for a group of people that only went for you for 11%? And there's a lesson to be learned here for the Democrats.
Okay.
The Republicans are conceding nothing. They're looking at that 89% as an opportunity. And I'm talking about the 89% of Black people who did not vote for them.
And they've got the time now, too. That, you know, Karl Rove is sitting around with nothing to do. You know, because his guy's done in 4 years. So he's like, well, you know what? We're going to get everybody.
But you know what? Rove and Ken Melman mm-hmm. have long maintained that they've wanted to do this. The mm-hmm. second Bush term now gives them the opportunity to implement something they've been very carefully crafting, just like the neocons were crafting the invasion of Iraq back in 95.
Okay.
This is not something new. What they are doing is what's new, actually, are some schisms that have begun to show themselves within the Black community.
Okay.
Number one, over same-sex marriage. Black clergy people are, I won't say four square against, but entirely too much, in my judgment, against any kind of discussion of same-sex marriage. That's why at the Crenshaw Center, which is the home of the Reverend Frederick K. Price in Los Angeles, there is a meeting of 100 Black clergy people and their representatives to discuss a concerted effort to mobilize the Black church against same-sex marriage.
What on a community level, Riley? What is the response to homosexuality in general in the Black community? Why is this such a stigma to them?
There is no general response. That's the scary part. There are some parts of the Black community that are very, very tolerant of the gay community that has always been a component. Go back to Audre Lorde, Langston Hughes, Barry Rustin, James Baldwin, all of these different mm-hmm. Black icons who were gay.
Yeah.
Okay, were not always able to come out and say they were gay, but they did.
Right.
There is, however, among clergy people will quote the Bible to you about why they cannot sanction or countenance not just same-sex marriage, but homosexuality in general.
But I just don't quite understand. I understand the hard line in terms of in terms of clergy, because it's almost their job.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? There's very few religious orders, certainly within Christianity, that accept gay marriages, that accept homosexuality in general.
I do.
Yeah, I mean, I do too. The church you go to
does. The church I go to does, and I'll tell you something right now, Mark Maron, I would not set foot in a church, white or black, whose pastor would give a sermon opposing gay marriage.
But what is the racket here? I mean, we were talking yesterday about faith-based initiative money. We were talking
That's part of it, too.
Okay.
It's all part and parcel of a coordinated strategy, and that's where the danger is for Democrats and Black progressives.
Well, let's get back to the schisms. How are they being exploited? You have this gay marriage schism, and what's the other one?
Well, the faith-based initiative.
Okay.
See, because that's money.
Mm-hmm.
And what the Bush White House has done has been to say, first of all, to stroke these Black clergymen by saying, we know that you all can provide certain services in your community better than government programs in your community, and we are prepared to give you the money as a faith-based charity to go out there and do that. And the inference is, look, if you want to do a little proselytizing, that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a big problem.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, Black clergy people, liking money like everybody else, have flocked to the idea of a faith-based initiative. To the point, Mark, that when I was covering the 2001 mayoral race here in New York City, black clergymen flocked to one of the candidates who said, I will set up an office of faith-based initiatives in my administration.
Right. Well, this doesn't sound like enough to sell the black community on Republicanism or whatever the version of Republicanism.
They don't have to sell all of them.
Well, but let me ask you a question, though, we were talking about before. What about the evolution of civil rights activism, and how does that fit in to this new Republican idea?
Okay, this is where they are exploiting an existing schism. When you talk about the civil rights orthodoxy of the black community, you are mm-hmm. now talking about something that is, in the main, 4 decades old.
Sure.
The civil rights movement started in the 50s and reached its apex in the late 1960s. For someone born in 1975, it means little or nothing without very, very careful nurturing, and I have to say, we haven't done the job.
Okay.
And when I say that, I'm talking about me as a black person, we as a community. We have not done a good enough job making the legacy of struggle that came forward in the 1960s something that was tangible and real beyond the 1960s. That's the problem.
Well, how does this play into the Republican idea, though?
The Republicans understand that, and they are now beginning to provide what they see as an alternative vision of black life that doesn't have anything to do with the civil rights struggles of the 1950s.
Self-empowerment.
Self-empowerment. Pull yourself up by the bootstraps. This is not new. Booker T. Washington embraced the same kind of philosophy over 100 years ago.
Mm.
But the bottom line is, a lot of black people don't know that. So those who don't know their history sometimes are doomed to repeat it. And now the Republicans understand that if they can get 25 to 30% of the black vote, they won't have to worry about how the rest of the country votes. They will be able to maintain the presidency and their majorities in Congress.
How do the Democrats react to this? I mean, what do we got to do?
Well, the Democrats have to react to it by reexamining. This is something we talked about even before we went on vacation.
Yeah.
The Democrats have to seriously reexamine their relationship to the black community. It is not good enough to say, oh yeah, you people are part of you're an important part of the base. Gee, that's wonderful. It doesn't work anymore. When you have somebody working actively against you, you have to become active. Otherwise, they will roll over you eventually.
Especially because these guys are going to be using the clergy to get
yes.
their needs met. Now, let's when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about the sort of the erosion of that historical awareness in the black community of the struggle,
yeah.
and also even in the context of history, I've got a piece here right in front of me about high school students. Who think that, the First Amendment
is for somebody else.
Yeah, and they think that flag burning is illegal. They don't see why the government shouldn't be able to edit newspaper stories. They just have no context for the historical struggle of this country on that level.
Yeah.
It's pervasive, but, we'll try and cover both when we come back. 43 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning's Edition, on the air. Online. Morning'sEdition.com, Air America Radio.
Okay, that's all right. I like the Stones better, but 47 past the hour. It's Mark Maron here. Mark Riley is over there.
Yo!
Did I say it's Morning's Edition on Air America Radio? Well, it is.
It is.
Today's day one of Black History Month. And you know what? I'm reading this article, Riley. This is a poll. A study taken from general high school students, right? Dig this. When told the exact text of the First Amendment, more than 1 in 3 high school students said it goes too far in the rights it guarantees.
Yeah.
Only half of the students said newspapers should be allowed to publish freely without government approval of stories. What is that? 3 in 4 students said flag burning is illegal. Okay.
Which
about,
is not.
Of course. About half the students said the government can restrict any indecent material on the Internet. It can't. Now, the problem here, other than we're obviously, we're creating morons, number one. We're creating people that have no context of what freedom of speech really means and what it's there to provide us and what the freedom gives us. And they have no context of history. And I am going to raise my hand right now, Mark Riley, and say, guilty. I am guilty because I was a bad student. I was a bad student.
So was I.
I didn't absorb. When I had American history, I know nothing. I still know relatively little. I still have to do a lot of research to put things into context of history. Because you know why? Because I care a lot about me. I care a lot about what I got to do. Where am I going? What's going to happen for me? What, you know, what about my, I barely remember my own personal history. Now, the problem with context in the day and age we live in is that, you know, a lot of it, with all the information you get, with all the different books, TV shows, with everything, you know, going on, you know, all the sort of, you know, clutter that is in the perception realm, it's very hard to say, here is the line of our history, and here is why this is important, and this is why this struggle, this is, it's very hard to muster up the empathy to put yourself in a situation that happened a long time ago. And this is sort of what you were saying around the you know, civil rights education in terms of the black history.
But see, this is the important part, Mark. You're talking about 100,000 students who were surveyed for this you know, attitudinal thing about the First Amendment. Now, a lot of people will look at that and say, gee, that's an awful thing. You know what the Republicans look at it?
Perfect.
They say, here's another opportunity.
Yeah, oh, they're like, this is great.
These are kids who in 5 years will be voting for the president, or actually in 4 years will be voting for the presidency of the United States.
But these are kids, through their misunderstanding, have deferred a lot of power to the government, and they think that's the way it is.
And they also have shown the Republicans a clear pathway to their ideology. Mm-hmm. See, the Republicans said, wait a minute, if these kids believe this now, then we can sell them on privatizing Social Security, on the justification for the war in Iraq, of our entire agenda, because they're going to be susceptible to it anyway, because they think government has powers it does not actually have.
But it's interesting, you know, we talk about institutionalized racism. This is institutionalized retardation. This is institutionalized, this is a progressive illness within the realms of education in this country. I mean, it's like we were talking last week about comparative religion classes.
Yeah.
Okay, I got another article here that says third graders at, you know, at certain schools in Virginia are encouraged and allowed to take a half hour out of the day at a specific time to go across the street to the church and get Bible classes. That's crazy. Again, that's institutionalized retardation. And the problem is this has to do with the structure of education, and this has to do with what you were talking about before in off the air about, you know, capturing the imagination of the young people.
Well, yeah, because I don't care if it's Black History Month, Women's History Month, whatever History Month. If all it is a history lesson, then people aren't going to retain it. You have got to create the context in the lives of people that you want to know about this.
Right. Well,
as to why it's relevant.
Exactly. Isn't that one of the reasons why, you know, Black History Month was established?
Well, yeah. Actually, it started out as Negro History Week.
Mm-hmm.
Carter Woodson, a noted black journalist, started it back actually in the, I think it was like somewhere in the early to late teens, right around World War I, was when he started with what was called Negro History Week. And it expanded over time into a month. And yes, its goals are laudable. But if you look at the end result, the end product of all of these years of Black History Month, what have you got? You've got young people who have not absorbed those lessons. And the reason, it's not their fault that they didn't absorb those lessons. It's my fault they didn't absorb those lessons. It's our fault as adults that we have not placed a proper priority in putting not just the black struggle, but progressive struggle in context so that young people don't think it's okay to restrict speech.
And also, it just seems to me that the history of this country has not been effectively integrated in terms of textbooks, in terms of context. I mean, I didn't get, you know, outside of not knowing much about, you know, U.S. history, I'm one of these people that believes that, you know, when the politically correct movement, you know, when African American studies started showing up in colleges, you know, some people say that that is, you know, that in itself is exclusionary. But I think that was one of the great things of the political correct process, is that because if we don't start to begin some process of getting a collective history, a truly collective history that can be taught, you know, starting at, you know, fourth grade, then, you know, we're screwed as a country, because it will always remain segregated. And you have either one group of people, you know, knowing their history, the other group of people knowing their history, and there's no collective.
You have to be able to convince people, young people of all races, that they themselves are a part of an historic process and that they themselves can make history. Let me give you a quick example of what I'm talking about.
Okay.
We can, without spending a dime of government money inside the black community, change. Now, we've been talking with Jim Earle, one of our writers, about changing our diets, okay? Now, there is an obesity problem among young black children that is astonishing to behold. Why? Because they end up eating in fast food joints all the time.
Mm-hmm.
All right, for whatever reason, their mothers don't cook. Whatever the reason is, the fact is black kids eat disproportionately in fast food restaurants. Suppose you went out and said to young people or said to their parents, you know what, we're going to show you how without spending an extra nickel you can stop your child from being fat. And you start showing them about green markets, you start showing them about produce, and you start with some real bare bones knowledge that we assume they have but many of them do not, about how to make a diet without spending a whole bunch. Because, see, the reason why a lot of people don't do this is because they think it costs more than going to a fast food joint. It doesn't.
It's convenience.
It's convenience.
I get it.
So a little bit of inconvenience. It's not. How inconvenient is it of you to make some of the dishes that you make at home?
Well, I like to do that. So basically what you're saying is to plant the seeds of where people come from historically, it has to happen, you know, at home when they're young, and
exactly.
it has to be something like, cause like as a Jewish person, when I went to Hebrew school, now I don't know where you learned a lot of black history, you know, in terms of, I imagine it was in the community and at home. Because,
at home, yeah.
Right. When I went to Hebrew school, I mean, we were told a lot of stuff, you know, about the Holocaust, about Jewish history, you know, but I never got that in school either. But it's all very selective. Why don't we take some calls? 866-303-2270 with some reflections on the context of history, on Black History Month, about some of the solutions that you might have in your own life or for us about, you know, how to make the historical American experience more of a collective experience on an educational level. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, there's a whole generation of black people who benefited from the Head Start program. Do you think that history's been told to anybody?
Right.
You know, and Head Start, by the way, had a nutritional component. That's why I was talking about food.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Because it had a breakfast, and the breakfast was supposed to be healthy.
Right.
That was part of the Head Start program.
Right.
So you can do those kinds of things. That's how you tie nutrition into history. You convince people, because people now in their 40s will look back on their time in Head Start and say, gee, you know, I really did learn a whole heck of a lot. And if you're able to change a person's diet, they can look back 20 years from now and say the same thing.
Right. Hey, there's a liberal agenda from the Streisand compound, 866-303-2270. Oh, geez. A lot of calls. Here's your marching order. Spin control. Hillary didn't faint. She was overcome with compassion. 2, hand these out to Democratic senators to use during tomorrow's State of the Union address. Duck calls, slide whistles, compressed air, horns. 3, if someone praises the Iraqi election, say, yeah, we used to be excited about voting, too. Here. All right. 4, bribe a presenter on Oscar night to open an envelope and say, and the winner should have been John Kerry. Who's with me, people? 5, today's phrase is dropping into conversation. At my house, every month is Black History Month, man. Wake up, sheeple. The man's got your car keys. So stay on the phone, folks.
Yeah.
866-303-2270. It's going to be a couple minutes, but we'll be with you in a minute.
That's right. This is Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition. Air America Radio.
Six past the hour. I'm Mark Maron here with Mark Riley, continuing on to talk about history and the context of history. It's Morning's Edition on Air America Radio. We're taking calls at 866-303-2270. Today is day one of Black History Month. I would like to say at the top of the hour here that I will be performing my Jerusalem Syndrome at the Pauley Center of Performing Arts near San Diego on February 12th. And I also will be performing at Symphony Space here in New York City on February 17th. You can go to the tour dates page on morningsedition.com for ticket info. Now, we were talking about the context of history. I was talking about how, you know, as a Jew, when I went to Hebrew school, we were sort of, you know, our head was filled with, you know, not only Bible stories or Old Testament stories and the history of the Jews, the Maccabees, Israel, whatnot, but really a core of our education as American Jews, you know, conservative Judaism, was the Holocaust. That, you know, like, you know, on a week-to-week basis, you know, sometimes we were shown movies of you know, bodies being plowed into pits. We were showed, you know, the piles of hair, you know, the standard footage that one sees from the Holocaust. But the context was, this can never happen again to Jews, all right? And then we got Jewish history. You know, this is, you know, this is where we come from, all right? Now, without a support system in terms of American history to integrate that experience, that education, cultural education that I got, that Jewish history, you know, in and of its own, it can be separating. It can be almost, you know, saying that, you know, above and beyond anything else, we're Jews. And, you know, if you don't say, if you don't have an American history program that integrates all these people into the American fabric of life, which is what is one of the great things about this country, then you have a history coming from different parts of the communities that are actually separating people. So what I'm saying is that, is there a collective? How does black history function in this way? Because it seems to me that some elements of black history and the black movement were actually, you know, founded in a certain separatism.
Well, yeah, it was an imposed separatism. In fact, there was a time in America when blacks were not allowed to study anything, much less history.
But, I mean, I'm talking, you know, post that, when, you know, when black identity became, you know, what was at the forefront of what the black movement was about, then that was a different type of separatism. It was an ideological separatism.
Well, yeah, and that All didn't right. come until, like, 40 years
right.
ago. But what you find, Mark, and I think this is kind of like where the idea of the whole ignorance of students and Black History Month come together, is the whole idea that you really have to reach people where they are. You cannot teach history by rote, whether it be in Black History Month, whether it be the First Amendment. You have to connect these things to the lives of the people that you're speaking to, because when you look at what's marketed to young people, that stuff is aimed directly at them.
Right.
And if you're competing by saying, well, back in the 1960s, we did this, this, and this, and you ought to do that too, or you ought to know about it because we did it, that doesn't resonate. What resonates is, these are the shoes you got to buy, these are the pants you ought to wear, these are the, you know, the hoodies that look best.
Right.
What a lot of people don't realize is that people are in competition. You know, progressives particularly are in competition with a larger culture that has no interest in progressive issues. It's as simple as that.
Well, you know, it's like it breaks my heart on some level, because, you know, I would have liked to, you know, had, you know, I would have liked to had a history professor or some idea of American history that really provided that sort of, you know, that core of, like, wow, you know, it doesn't matter where we come from, we are all part of this. You know, and the reason we're part of this is because the Constitution enables it. It's been the legacy of this country to have, you know, people come from other places and integrate into this system, and to actually have an effective, you know, education around American history that would really cross, you know, culture lines, cross race lines, cross gender lines, and everything else. So you really got that feeling that we really are all American.
Well, see, there is, and I think has been, a different experience there for white ethnics and for black people.
Mm-hmm.
Because for black people, that same American history where, you know, people from other cultures were able to come here and merge didn't happen
right,
until the
1960s. Right.
And to a large extent, black people are still dealing with the aftermath of that merger. That's
sure.
why you're seeing this assault on civil rights and political black political orthodoxy. That's why you see you know, the Republican Party reaching out to these folks, and you're going to see them reach out to these young people as well.
And you were talking about the young people, about young black people not having a context for some of this history. It's interesting because this is really recent.
Yeah.
I mean, this is like what you're saying is profound, because it's really recent that, you know, that black people got their, you know, basic human rights in this country. I mean, it's like two generations.
Well, yeah, and see, the thing is, I lived a little bit of that history.
Sure.
I'll never forget, as long as I lived, riding down 7th Avenue in Harlem, in the middle of, you know, at that time they called them race riots. It was in the middle of a very big disturbance that was going on 7th Avenue. And somebody hurled, it was either a watermelon or something, off the roof of a building, and it hit the top of our car.
Mm.
It was one of the scariest. I was like 11 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, whoa, wait a minute, what's going on here? And my parents had to explain to me exactly what was going on here. This was something that was going on before my very eyes. Demonstrations, the March on Washington, Goodman, Cheney, and Schwerner happened when I was 12 years old.
Wow.
So all of that stuff had to be explained in a contemporary context for me, because it was going on. That's not the case for black or white young people.
And it's interesting right there that a lot of young black people don't realize that there was an alliance between Jewish progressive liberals and the black community. A lot of people don't realize that there's an alliance between blacks and Jews that is outside the music business.
Absolutely.
Let's take a quick call. Pablo, listening to WINZ in Miami, good morning.
Hey, Pablo.
Hey, good morning, guys. How you doing?
It's good.
Your show. I'm glad to get on.
Okay, what's on your mind?
I love your topic. I happen to be a social studies teacher here in Miami.
Mm-hmm.
And, I was very interested by your poll. I have some comments on that, really. I have the luxury, I guess, or the pleasure of teaching mostly seniors, and I teach them government and economics. And, there are a lot of misconceptions. A lot of them do think that certain things are illegal, and then you have to open up their minds and let them know, you know what, the Supreme Court has said, like Bernie, is freedom of speech.
Right.
And the government can't get into each and every aspect of what's produced, what's disseminated as information, and so forth. Now, they have that misconception, but what I find is once their minds are cleared and they know that the truth is something else, they're very, very accepting of it, and for the most part, they're fairly progressive on all social and domestic issues.
Well, they probably feel freed on some level. They probably, immediately just want to tell you to go screw yourself.
Not you, Pablo.
They can't go to the bathroom. Anyway, but they, I have a lot of mostly Hispanics in my school, 97%. So I find that they're a little bit more conservative on issues relating to, their country of origin or their parents' country.
In what way, Pablo?
As in, the ones that maybe are from Colombia are more hardcore for Uribe, who's kind of the more right-wing
guy,
conservative guy. Because of their experience, they left their country because of the Civil War, blah, 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 whatever. And the Venezuelans, maybe because of Chavez, and the Cuban Americans, obviously, because of historical...
Well, that's an interesting point you bring up.
In general, on social issues, on domestic issues, really do tend to be more liberal and progressive.
Well, that's great. That's great to hear. Thanks for your call. It's an interesting thing he brings up is that, when you have new immigrants coming from cultures that are in turmoil or incredibly, violent or compromised. I mean, I see a lot of immigrants from the Ukraine, and God knows what some of them lived through, when the collapse of the Soviet Union, Bosnia, and people that come from, countries where there's an incredible amount of struggle that I can't even fathom, or you can't even fathom the immediate sort of, tyranny that they escaped or that kind of stuff. Then you have these personal histories that have to be, integrated into our cultural history as well. I mean, to have an appreciation for the struggles or for the excitement of a recent immigrant to this country escaping true brutality, of a kind that, I certainly don't understand in my generation.
Oh, no, and let me explain something else. There are very few students in America, white, black, Latino, or whatever, that are being taught now about the democratization of South America.
Mm-hmm.
Most people have no clue that 25, 30 years ago, most of the regimes in South America were dictatorships.
And killing thousands of people.
Yeah, but they no longer are.
Wow.
And it's one of the great stories of this hemisphere, but American kids don't hear about it.
I want to go to class. Can we go to class? We're gonna focus exclusively on your call next segment. So please keep hanging on. And 866-303-2270 is our number. It's a very invigorating topic. We'll be back in a second. 15 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Join the morning tradition right now. Call 866-303-2270.
What?
That's 866-303-2270.
You don't know until you've tried this.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Damn good.
That's right, 20 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
Taking calls about history, the context of Black History Month, 866-303-2270. And let me do this real quick. As my dream diary, which is an optimistic dream. It says, I go to the therapist on Thursday. I'm in a large, clean, well-lit space. Here there's no weather, no time. Only distant music and order and calm. Everywhere, people move freely, unhurried, without stress. Outside, there may be chaos and hate, but in here, harmony and singularity of purpose reign. In this house, all rifts are healed and all conflicts have been resolved. Arab, Jew, black, white, North Korean, South Korean, Aston, Jolie, Chinese and Tibetan, young and old, American and Iraqi, Red Sox and Yankees, Protestant and Catholic, Barbara Boxer and Condi Rice all look on their former nemesis knowingly with contented smiles. All other truths are reduced to this. I want what you want, and you want what I want. I think to myself, perhaps human civilization has finally overcome its primitive hostility, its blind prejudices, and joined voices in a common anthem of hope. In this Eden, this paradise, this clean, well-lit space, I walk outside and gaze up at a strange vision glowing yellow in the sky. It says, IKEA. I feel a great swell of pride as I went inside to buy the Ektorp love seat in the Beginge White for $449. High resilient polyurethane foam seat cushions provide great sitting and comfort. I woke up and my bed was filled with Strommling cutlery caddies. These caddies.
Hey. Do they have a Black History Month sale at IKEA?
I don't know. Are there black people in Sweden? There are. Yeah. Jonathan's giving me the yes. They're very happy, he said, in my head. We're talking about not only Black History Month, but the context of history, the education process of history, obviously there's a lot of calls here, so let's just take them. I don't think I set that up that well, but basically what we're talking about is there's an article in the paper today as well about high school students who thought that the First Amendment was a little too harsh, and that flag burning might be against the law, that the government should be entitled and allowed to edit newspaper articles. I mean, there is we are institutionalizing not only racism but retardation on some level. So here we go. Tim, listening to KSNB in Minneapolis. Good morning, Tim.
Hey, Tim.
Hey, how you guys doing?
All good, right. Good.
Yeah, it was really nice talking to you. I've been listening to you for quite a while now.
Well, thanks for calling.
Now, anyway, to the point, mm-hmm. I think that you make an assumption that African-American kids aren't really aware of the history and the struggle. And, my point is that you can still get stopped driving while black. We just went through two elections where one of the major parties, the Republican Party, spent millions of dollars to prevent blacks from voting. You know what I'm saying? This is not something that happened yesterday. Hello? Okay. This is not something that happened yesterday. And I think that one of you guys had mentioned Booker T. Washington. You know what I'm saying? There is a lot of African Americans out there that have learned to get in the short line. They've learned that you can get power, influence by making racist people, racist institutions comfortable with what they do. Mm. Booker T. Washington made the nation comfortable with lynching.
Mm.
Condoleezza Rice made the country comfortable when we start talking about issues like affirmative action. Let me tell you two guys something. There's not a black born in this society in the last 100 years that don't believe in affirmative action. But there's a lot of them that will tell you that they don't believe in it. I don't want that stigma, put on me or whatever. But you either going to have affirmative action, or you're going to have, or racism disappears.
Well, why does this happen? Why?
You got to have one. You got to have one another. And Armstrong Williams understands that, but he also understands that he can make millions of dollars by going around the country telling people that there's something wrong with affirmative action. And that's what the problem is, that we don't have the voice. America, and what you guys are doing is beautiful, because the voices aren't out there. You know what I'm saying? Michael Powell sits up there, the head of the FCC.
Okay.
And what does he do? He limits our voices to speak on any level.
Okay. But what? I agree to some extent with what Tim is saying. But the other side of it is that in many instances, the voices are out there, but they're not being listened to.
But isn't what he's saying also is that many black Americans facilitate the appropriation of blacks by the dominating structures, by the dominating institutions, by the Republican Party, because they're willing to sell themselves out on some points?
Well, it's interesting. When you talk about Armstrong's great-grandfather was a Republican. Armstrong Williams' family's been voting Republican since just after the Civil War.
But am I misunderstanding? understanding his point in saying that, you know, what he's saying is one of the problems with education and what you were saying is in keeping it current and in making the experience real for them is that, you know, we have to point out the fact that blacks were stifled in their voting efforts in Ohio. We have to point out
that
Booker T. Washington made certain things, you know, acceptable that shouldn't have been acceptable.
That's an absolute truth. And the whole idea of driving while black is an important issue because that's something that can happen to literally any black person, young, old, or whatever. It tends not to happen to older black people, but certainly for younger black people, you have to make that real for them. It's not something that you can just pull a rabbit out of a hat. You have to say, look, you can do something about racial profiling in your community, in your state, in your country.
Right, and through that taking that action, there can also be an elevated awareness as to, you know, the struggle that's gone on before, actions that have been taken previous, how this compares to other actions in the history of the black experience. I mean, you know, then that's sort of what you were talking about earlier in terms of making it real and keeping it present, and also, you know, realizing that, you know, this is a legacy of struggle and that a lot of things have improved, but this is an ongoing struggle.
I couldn't have said it better. Absolutely.
All right. Well, you know, after we come back here, you know, I'm going to get into the liberal confessional because I have sinned, and as you know, every week we like to hear your sins as well, so get ready for that call-in segment, 866-303-2270 with your liberal transgressions. We'll be back, right, Riley?
And we'll be right back here on Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Sound mortgage.
Thirty-four past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yep.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. We're going to be taking your calls in just a second with your liberal confessions. 866-303-2270 is the number. But first, I want to drop this email on you people because I've got a couple of these, and I want to, you know, just put this to rest. In honor of George Lakoff, you should be the first liberal talking heads. And, oh, just for information, not a plus to call people talking heads. It's not a complimentary thing, unless you're from the other side, and I don't know by this email. You should be the first liberal talking heads to stop calling the Iraqis fighting against the U.S. insurgents. In World War II, they would have been called freedom fighters or the resistance. Stop using the right's language to make them seem less than what they are. Okay, question. Are you out of your mind? All right, how about that? First of all, to insurgent, by dictionary definition, by one of the primary definitions, a member of an irregular armed force that fights a stronger force by sabotage or harassment. So on that level, insurgent is defined as exactly what it is. Now, I think what you're trying to do is trying to tell me that the frame terrorist is another issue. But to call this insurgency, this fairly complex group of different types of people, you know, jihadists, disenfranchised, just pissed off Iraqis, ex-Baathists who want to sabotage the government, I mean, certainly jihadists are not, their goal is not to free the people or to create a freedom in Iraq.
No.
And the Baathists, even the Baathists, their goal is really not for freedom. It is to sabotage the current government to probably, you know, either reinstate tyranny or not. That's up in there. But to call them, okay, let's try your frame. I'm going to reframe that. Okay, I'm going to do this for our emailer who wants us to, you know, to call the insurgency freedom fighters. Freedom fighters today used a child with Down syndrome as a suicide bomber on election day, Iraqi Interior Minister Falah al-Naqib said today. See, how does that work? The freedom fighters are using retarded children as bombs. Well, that's right. Well, I hope they get that freedom that they're fighting for. Hey, why don't you just go in there, put this on, and there's candy inside. Go on in. There's candy. All right. Anyway, so let's do the liberal confessional. Kind of heavy, huh? Kind of weird. Here we go. Sometimes it's not easy being a liberal. We all stray from the straight and narrow from time to time. But when we need to unburden ourselves, we can always confess our liberal sins. If you want to take a turn in the liberal confessional, give us a call at... Hold on a minute. I forgot to do one thing. I forgot to do something. Please, go ahead and get some candy. All right, if you want to take a turn in the liberal confessional, give us a call at 866-303-2270. That's 866-303-2270. But right now, it's my turn. Bless me, Brother Riley, for I have sinned.
How can I ease your burden, my son?
Well, Brother Riley, it would appear that I have been insensitive to the feelings of people with mental disabilities, but not as insensitive as the freedom fighters who strapped a bomb to a kid with Down syndrome.
I should hope not.
No, of course not. Hell, it's not even the mentally ill per se that I'm accused of being insensitive to. It's their friends, Riley.
And who would these people be?
Teddy bears, Mark. Teddy bears.
Say what? Teddy bear?
Yeah. But the teddy bears don't seem to have a problem with me, and neither do their mentally ill friends. It's friends of the mentally ill who are friends with the teddy bears that seem to be in an uproar. Does that make any sense, Riley?
I am relieved to say it does not.
All right, let me clear it up. Look, as we discussed yesterday, a company put out these crazy-for-you teddy bears that were in straitjackets and had commitment papers, all right? Little goofy commitment papers. And since I don't really have a problem with it, some folks think that I would approve of any kind of sick novelty item, a self-mutilating Barbie or a G.I. Joe with post-traumatic stress syndrome, a Smurf serial killer, you name it.
Well, Brother Mark, would you approve of such things?
Well, it would depend on the joke and the context. You know, there'd be so much less pain in the world of political correctness if folks would just be more aware of context.
Amen to that. I have a light penance for you this week, my son. I want you to hug a teddy bear.
All right, well, that's not so bad.
In public!
Oh, man, that's harsh.
Now go forth and sin no more.
With my teddy bear, yeah. Well, Brother Riley, thanks for easing my burdens. If anyone else out there wants to confess and seek absolution in our liberal confessional, you can give us a call right now at 866-303-2270. That's 866-303-2270. Let's start.
We didn't do the same.
Amen. That was nice. Christina in New York City, what's going on? What do you got? What have you sinned? What is your sin?
Well, I don't think it's a sin, but I feel really bad about it.
All right, confess.
I called Right Wing Radio late one Saturday night, and because he asked, I don't know, even know who it was. It was a slow night, and I'm hooked on talk radio, and he asked, why haven't there been any terror alerts? This is right after the election.
Yeah.
A couple of weeks after.
Okay.
I had right away, I'm an Air America listener. I knew the answer right away because Bush doesn't need to scare us anymore. So it was a perfect question for me to answer, And the thing is, none of the other right-wing callers called in on it. Everyone's bringing up all sorts of other topic, teenagers and all this, stuff. And he got into this globalization thing. So I've been waiting. My heart's palpitating. And this is, I had never called any, I've called Air America since, but I had never called radio before.
Yeah.
So I was real nervous, and when it got to be my turn, I weighed in on this globalization issue and ended up actually agreeing with him.
Oh.
And then I felt like it was a missed opportunity. It will probably never come again because I hate right wing.
Oh.
And I was just listening because, I like to hear the other side and whatever. I listen to
Well, that can be a sin if you get addicted to it.
Well, no, I don't. I can only take like 2-3 minutes at a time.
so you felt pretty bad that you didn't get to address what you wanted to say. Then
yeah,
the topic changed.
People who were listening to it, and he had actually asked for an answer to that. Nobody else had given it, and I had a zinger for him. It was short.
But then they changed the subject, and then they suckered you in, and you ended up agreeing and walking away.
I told the screener what I was going to say, and he let me through. I was like, great, I got through. And I got a zinger for all this.
But you felt ashamed, didn't you?
I did.
Mm. I have a penance for her.
A weak and a wimp and a weenie and all that stuff you're talking about last week.
Well, Mark Riley's got a penance for
I've
you.
I've got a penance for you.
Yeah.
Christina, you need to do something else with your Saturday nights. I have a suggestion.
I'm glad you didn't say I had to call him again.
No! I've got something even better.
Yeah.
Okay.
Go to morningsedition.com.
Uh-huh.
Go to the tour dates page.
Yeah.
Get in contact with the Poway Center for the Performing Arts near San Diego. Mark Maron will be there on Saturday, February 12th. Your penance is to fly to San Diego see Maron's show at the Poway Center, and that way you won't have to worry about calling anybody on any future Saturdays. How's that?
Expense-free?
No. No, you got to pay.
Well, here's
we don't have any money here.
Here is my easier penance, which is probably going to hurt you even more, is that you have to call back the Right Wing Radio show and pretend like you're in agreement with the host and then surprise them.
think I'll go to San Diego.
No! All right, thank you. Thank you for calling, Christina. You take care. All right. Michael, listening to LIB in Brooklyn, what's your sin, my friend?
Oh, what can I tell you, Mark? This is the deal. I'm feeling pretty guilty about the fact that we now have our thumb on 20% of the world's known oil reserves, and I'm feeling pretty good about that, especially after going through that oil embargo when those sheikhs just pulled the plug on us. I'm feeling pretty bad that George is not able to pull this off. 50 years from now, he's going to look like a hero.
So you feel bad for enjoying the fact that we've got most of the oil under our thumb, yet have those prices come down at all, Mike?
Last night it went from $2.02
to $1.99.
So, ooh, wow, 2 cents a gallon savings.
So they may have all the oil, but they're still kind of screwing us, aren't they, Mike?
Well, at least it's flowing, Mark.
Yeah, but Mike, remember during the last couple of years of Bill Clinton, what was the price of a gallon of gas? About 75 cents.
Yeah, that's true. But we're not there now. We're here now.
I know.
Okay, well,
I mean,
here's your penance, Mike. You have to go to the most expensive gas station and fill your car up for a week and then really think about the benefits of having all the oil.
Oh, my goodness.
All right, take care, Mike. Oh, my goodness.
He went for it.
866-303-2270. Let's take one more call here. Let's see. We're taking more calls, but we're about to. Anyway, Stephanie, who's sitting in Madison, Wisconsin, on the mic. What's up, Stephanie? What's your sin?
Lucky Father is for I have sinned. It has been aeons since my last confession.
Okay.
Ooh. Oh, I watch trash TV. And listen to some sexist, trashy radio, not trashy, but really funny radio, five times this week, this last week. I watched The Bachelorette.
Ooh.
And I watched The Apprentice.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed them. And, I listened to Bob and Tom, who I sometimes listen to, and they mm-hmm. had some real sexist stuff, and I was laughing at it.
Yeah. Sometimes that's funny. What are you going to do? Bob and Tom are funny guys.
They are funny guys. They are really funny. It's really funny stuff.
Okay, all right. Take it easy.
don't hide the competition too much here.
I get it. They're really funny. I understand.
Yeah.
It took me away
Let's
from
move
public
on.
Radio and from Air America and from public TV and, all that high mindset.
What are they on out there? Are they on at the same time we are?
Yeah, they started. Actually, they started at 5. I think it's 5:30, yeah.
So you were listening to them other than us?
For a little bit, yeah, and I flipped you guys on.
Wow, now
Mark,
I'm...
Mark,
now
Mark are on.
I'm hurt, man.
Yeah, me too.
Well, you know what
I'm
you got to do? I have to tell you something. You've got to hold on, and then we're going to tell you your penance when we come back. How's that,
okay.
Gregory? And don't go to Bob and Tom. No going to Bob and Tom on the break.
That's right.
Oh, no.
All right,
don't
you move. Just you stay
I'm
right there.
I'm doing my laundry right now.
Are you doing your laundry? Well, now you're going to do your laundry and wait for us to give you your penance. 45
okay.
past the hour, Air America Radio. We'll be right back.
Join the Morning Sedition. Right now, call 866-303-2270.
What?
That's 866-303-2270.
You don't know until you've tried this.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Damn good.
Forty-nine past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
866-303-2270. We're taking the liberal confessions. We got Stephanie on the phone in Madison, Wisconsin, listening to the mic, who has just confessed to us a very lengthy sort of week of watching The Apprentice, The Bachelorette, listening to Bob and Tom, and she feels guilty because she had a good time. Now, Stephanie, Bob and Tom, I've done that show. Those guys are good guys. So I need you, the first part of your penance is to shoot them an email and say how much you love Mark Maron and Mark Riley in the morning.
Okay.
And that, that you go back and forth between our shows, but tell them to watch their backs because Maron's funny. All right. Can you do that?
I can do that.
All right, here's the other one. Do you like sports?
I do.
Okay. Well, then, here's what you're going to have to do for the next week. For a week, you need to watch. I want you to watch reality television. I just want it to be C-SPAN. And I want you to watch maybe 2-3 hours a day of C-SPAN.
Uh-huh. Oh, no.
And I'm sad to say that you're going to have to also listen to NPR in the morning for 4 days.
Oh, no. In here, I was like so... I mean, I love NPR. I've always been a public radio junkie, but after listening to you guys and listening to Air America, it's like it's hard for me to go back.
Well, then that doesn't sound like penance. You know what? You're just going to have to put your radio in between stations and listen to that for 3 hours a day.
Yeah, right. Christian, I was listening to Christian radio too, so you know, I'll have to do that. But anyway.
Oh boy, you need help.
Reality bending.
Now I'm starting to feel bad. You do your penance, and then we'll help you again another time.
Thank you.
All right, Stephanie. Bye.
Thank you, Stephanie. Wow.
It's all starting to come out. I listen to Christian radio, and I can't stop. Oh, okay. Let's take another call. Gene in South Carolina. How are you, Gene? Listening to XM. What's your sin?
Well, there's about a two-mile stretch of highway I have to drive every day on my way to work, and it goes through a marsh. It's beautiful, serene. It brings me comfort when I drive through there, and,
yeah.
it's a favorite place for politicians to put their signs.
Right.
And this last election, the whole stretch was just littered with signs, and I got frustrated with it one morning on my way to work, and I mowed down about a good half-mile stretch. And, they were flying over my hood and into the marsh, and I caused some environmental harm there.
Oh, but God, that must have felt great.
Well, it was liberating. Yeah, being a liberal in this area is kind of like being it's difficult.
Yeah, sometimes it just doesn't come. Yeah, I know.
It's like a gerbil in a Key West pet shop. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Ooh, that was a little bad.
Yeah.
But now you got to do penance for that joke too.
Well, there's a subtext here. I had my 8-year-old in the car. He saw the whole thing and chuckled the whole time.
Oh, while you're plowing over the not right now to explain your sad gerbil joke, but
yeah.
Right. But Gene. Well, anyways, it sounds to me what you got to do is you're going to have to go clean the marsh. No.
I drove by about 2 days later, and there were some little young Republicans out there getting their loafers dirty.
Oh, so now you feel a little bit vindicated because you made young Republicans, you're assuming young Republicans, clean up the marsh.
Precisely.
Well, I still think you're going to have to clean something up, Gene. maybe the part of your brain that is homophobic might be a good start.
I'm not homophobic. Come on. Actually, my friend who is gay told me that joke. So.
Oh, okay. So that makes it okay. So you've got a gay friend that tells gerbil jokes. All right. Well, here, how about that? Let's see. What's the penance got to be, Riley? I think you're gonna have to. I think you're gonna have to sort of volunteer to clean up. I think maybe on the highway. Maybe you know what? Next time you see a bunch of prisoners in their orange outfits cleaning up,
stop your car.
Just stop your car and get out and just help them without saying anything.
Yeah,
we do have a stretch of highway here that's cleaned up by an atheist group. I always wonder, you know, those people must wear body armor when they're out there.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
That's
Why don't you be the only guy cleaning up on the atheist stretch?
Yeah.
Okay, thanks,
guys. All right, take it easy. He didn't sound like he was going to do it.
I don't know, maybe.
Oh, boy.
I think the prisoner thing was better, though.
The prisoner? Yeah. No, I like that.
Although you can get locked up, you know, just like jumping out and helping a bunch of prisoners.
They don't have that in every state where the prisoners help out. Trisha, listening to KLSD in San Diego. I'm going to be there in a couple weeks. Hi.
Hello.
What's your sin?
I'm going to come see you.
Oh, good.
I was raised by two very good liberal parents, and in 96, when I first had the opportunity to vote for president, I voted for Perot.
Wow.
I know, and I'm such a good liberal. I don't have a TV. My dad sends me articles from The Guardian.
You don't have a TV.
I eschew all animal products. And
you do?
Yoga, hippie, freaking herbal. I've worked for Kucinich in the primaries. I mean... But, yeah, and when I said that to them, you know, I always have to confess. I always tell people, you know, I voted for Perot, and they look at me like...
Well, it sounds to me, by the way you've explained your life, that penance is a pretty regular thing for you.
Yeah, it's probably my aesthetic qualities were nurtured by that discretion there, digression.
I guess your penance is going to have to be bacon. Someone's going to have to eat a plate of bacon.
Ooh.
Oh, my God. Oh.
Yeah, oh, my God. Yeah, I'd probably like it.
No. Oh, you're exciting.
Oh, man.
All right, so it sounds like you live a pretty hard life, and you're already living the life of ascetic. What do you think? Can we let her off the hook? She doesn't sound that ashamed of it anymore.
Well, you know what it is? It's one thing to say, well, you voted for Perot, he's a conservative, but, you know, Perot was just, like,
nuts.
I was stupid. I mean, I was 18, 19. I was, you know, you're dumb at that age.
Well, okay, well, there you go. Well, then you're going to have to go out and reach out to an 18 or 19-year-old and make them undumb somehow.
Yeah.
Oh, I can do that.
Okay.
Uh-oh.
Now I'm starting
not
to wish,
that way.
Wish I was younger. Hey, okay, we'll be back. No, I'm kidding. We're not going anywhere. Thanks, Tricia. Introduce yourself to me when I'm in San Diego.
Wow, that's great. So you'll get a chance to meet Trish.
She's funny.
Yeah.
I mean that in a completely nice way. I'm not saying, you know, I'm happily married, but she just got the tone of her voice about
you heard the thing
about bacon.
Her first vote was in 96.
All right, let's take one more quick call. Doug, you there? Doug, what's your sin?
Yeah.
What's your sin?
Hey. Is it too early for you guys to be a first time, long time?
I don't know what that means.
First time calling.
Oh, yeah, go ahead. Oh, go ahead.
All right, well, I kind of lost my bathing suit, and I had to stop at a Walmart and pick one up.
Okay. So were you naked?
What's that?
Were you naked when you went in?
Almost.
Well, that's your penance. You have to go back to Walmart naked.
The worst thing about it was there was a Ma and Pa's discount bathing suit store right next door.
All right, you have to go in there naked, too.
Yeah, both.
Both. Okay, Doug, thank you. That's your penance. Go to Walmart naked and say, I need clothes.
Ooh.
No, go to the mom and pop store, Doug, and buy some there. Help them out. I try to do that all I can. And it's not hard. It's not here. It's not hard here.
No.
So what happens now? We go on away for a break, and we're coming back again later?
We got a action-packed last hour.
Donnie Fowler. That was a pretty racy half hour there. Donnie Fowler, the candidate for DNC chair, up against Howard Dean and several other people, but it looks like it might come down. Fowler and Dean is going to tell us what he's going to do for the Democratic Party.
That's right. He made some news yesterday, and we've got him today.
Right on.
Stay with us. This is Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
All right, 6 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley. Moving on.
Yeah.
What a morning it's been. Very exciting. Thanks for all your calls. Thanks for all the input. A couple of great call-in segments today that you missed if you're just coming in. But welcome aboard. Welcome, Memphis.
Yeah.
WWTQ 680 AM, our newest affiliate. Nice to be down there. Hope everything's going okay for you today. I will be performing at the Poway Center for the Performing Arts. That's near San Diego on February 12th. I will be doing the Jerusalem Syndrome, which I've gotten into my head, back in my head finally. the mega mammoth monologue of, you know, complete neurotic, grandiose spiritual confusion. Very entertaining, I must say myself. It's also excited to time travel because, you know, it's interesting when you re-engage with a story from your life that you haven't told in a while, Riley. All of a sudden it's like, wow, there I am again. Also, I'll be at Symphony Space in New York on February 17th. You can get information on these if you go to the tour dates page on morningsedition.com. What else have we got going on? A lot of stuff. Let's do this. Here we go. We're going to start doing a new bit here that's in its... it's in its fetal state right now. It's roughly called the Headline Translator, where we're going to take headlines that exist in the news and spin them properly.
Okay.
You know, rewrite them. Like this is from the New York Times today. Vote over Iraq faces task of forming a government. Translation, Iraqi search for winning candidates believes still in hiding. Ballot complications blamed, spider holes combed. From the New York Daily News, jury selection begins on Jackson case. Translation, hunt continues for lucky dozen who don't know Jacko. Hey. From the CNN.com, here we go. Matrix star Keanu Reeves joins the Walk of Fame. Translation, commerce defeats art, accepts prize. Yeah,
wow.
That ain't going to be bad. Also, look at this. I've got the stem cells. This is an interesting story, all right, because apparently scientists have actually used stem cells. This is a medical research area that our president has decided is wrong. All right, the Pope decided it was wrong. You know, the fanatics have decided it's wrong to take you know, stem cells, clusters of cells that are represent nothing more than a cluster of cells, really, but can be very helpful in possibly creating cures, actual cures to disease. Apparently, if you take a stem cell and you throw in a little bit of a little bit of these certain biological ingredients, just a little mixture, that they can create actual motor neurons. All right, these are the basic. These are the cells that create movement.
Yeah.
So they're thinking that maybe if you can infuse this into the spinal fluid, that you might start to be able to really treat some serious muscular disorders. Which just takes it closer to what I'm really hoping for, Riley. I'm really hoping that at some point in my lifetime, as my body starts to break down and my organs start to go bad on me, I will be able to walk into a health food store or a special sort of doctor's office and just say, can I have the stem cell smoothie, please? I'd like the one that will regenerate my lungs. Can I have that?
That's the stem cell cafe, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just like, wouldn't it be amazing if they got to a point with this type of technology where some of the more debilitating illnesses and some of the more degenerative diseases are actually cured, you know, if we can promote this research. Everywhere else in the world is doing it.
I know. And, you know, the amazing thing about what you just said is you're talking about the possibility of curing long-term paralysis. People who may have never been able to walk after a certain period of time, after a car accident or something like that, this kind of research holds out the possibility that they might be able to walk again.
Yeah, and absolutely. It's a great possibility. And this is the other thing that kind of gets me. This is interesting when I see how politics works in all areas. Like, there's apparently been some new elements added to the list of carcinogens, right, that include viruses. All right, the government is adding viruses to the list of suspected causes of cancer, hepatitis C and B. They're also, you know, adding lead, X-rays, and compounds in grilled meats are joining the list. Now, the interesting thing about this is that we've always known...
Wait. Whoa. No, what was that again? Say that again.
Okay. Lead, okay. X-rays, okay. And compounds in grilled meats.
Lead. Something that you use for a sap to hit somebody upside the head.
Well, lead has always been there. You know, it's lead paint, lead, okay. Lead in the water. I mean, lead is a carcinogen. X-rays, you should have known something's wrong when you got to wear the lead vest.
And grilled meat.
Yeah, okay. Well, grilled meat...
I'm just trying to make the association.
Well, but that's an interesting thing you bring up. It's like, you know, when you say something like that, what does that mean? Are people supposed to start, you know, not eating grilled meat? Because on some level, grilled meat is actually better than, you know, cooking it in butter.
Or eating it raw.
Right, but this is just a trace element that happens when you grill meat. But there's a lot of good things about it, too. It cancels the stuff out, all right? So you got to take certain things with a grain of salt and think, well, how much will it take?
Okay.
But it's very interesting that... In terms of politics, is what I was saying, is that, you know, the radiation, the people, the radiologist board. I lost it. That bothers me.
No, don't worry about that. Take your time.
Yeah. Well, no. Basically, what they're saying is the people that represent radiologists, the people that represent the people that take X-rays,
okay,
said like, whoa. You're going to stifle people from getting, you know, medical help. That there's always a sort of a political element to these things. We've all known that X-rays take, you know, cause cancer.
Yeah.
You know, if you get them every other day, or if you get too many of them. That's why when you go to the dentist, they say don't get too many X-rays. You only get them if you absolutely need them. But on some, that's someone else's bread and butter. So there's always these sort of compromises and need for diplomacy. When something like this happens, like this, you know, the radiologists are like, dude, you know, now people are gonna, we need people to get X-rays.
To get X-rays, yeah. Otherwise, we're out of work.
So there just has to be some sort of weird thing. And I guess the example I'm trying to make here is that the more I get involved in reading about politics and the more, you know, sort of back and forth that goes on in negotiating things,
mm-hmm.
you know, so people can be happy in their camps. It's like it never ends.
Because
Riley.
Everything is political. Because each action that you take, almost no matter what it is, no matter how seemingly trivial, no matter how you may be trying to do something for the environment, for your fellow man or whatever, it's, you know what it is? It's a microcosm of the same Walmart debate.
Right.
Okay? On the one hand, Walmart is bad for workers, etc., etc., etc. On the other hand, you get you get stuff cheap. And you got to make a choice.
Right.
You got to make a choice about which one you want.
I guess that's why I get frustrated. By the way, it's the American College of Radiology faulted the addition of X-rays and gamma rays there. I guess that's why I find certain things frustrating, is that when you really start to realize it, that, as you said, everything's political and these things never end. Yeah. That there's no point in which it's like, there, everything's fixed.
It's never going to be fixed.
Right. So now we have, you know, the Democratic National Committee chair election.
Yes.
Now, and this is like, there's all sorts of different factions that are revolving around this that are, you know, is essentially political because it's politics, yeah. Right? Dean looks like the front runner. And Dean, you know, I'm into Dean because I think he's going to reinvigorate the base. He's going to stick to our core values. He's going to, you know, take people to task that don't stick to our core values. But there's plenty of people who are like, well, we don't need somebody that extreme. We need room for compromise. We have Donnie Fowler, who's going to be on our show, you know,
yes.
Moments, you know, in the next half hour. And he's also running. He might be the other contender who's going to be right up against Dean, who's going to have his vision of how the Democratic Party should work. Because there's a lot of people that believe in moving towards the center. And from what I understand, there really is no center, which is why I'm pretty pro-Dean. Because if you like, let's take a look at this. This is from David Sirota, and he did this in The Nation, primarily just, you know, some points about why centrism does not really exist. The myth is, by attacking President Bush and the Republicans for siding with the super wealthy, Democrats are waging class warfare, which will hurt Democrats at the ballot box. Fact. In March 2004, a Washington Post poll found a whopping 67% of Americans believe the Bush administration favors large corporations over the middle class. An NBC poll on Election Day 2004 found that 55% of the voters believe the same thing. Now, that should be apparent to everybody. Myth. If Democrats hammer corporations for their misbehavior and push for a serious crackdown on corporate excess, the party will be hurt by an anti-business image. What are we, wussies? All right, fact. A 2002 Washington Post poll taken during the height of the corporate accounting scandals found that 88% of Americans distrust corporate executives, 90% want new corporate regulations, tougher enforcement of existing laws, and more than half think the Bush administration is not tough enough in fighting corporate crime. Myth. Proposing to repeal the Bush tax cuts to pay down the deficit will alienate millions of voters. Fact. The pollster for the Democratic Leadership Council found in 2001 that a majority of Americans support such a policy and that a strong plurality of voters would actually be more likely to vote for a Democrat who endorsed this proposal. A September 2004 CBS News poll found that 72% of Americans say they either have not been affected by Bush tax cuts or that their taxes have actually gone up. See, now, there is a myth of this center. And at some point, and this is why, you know, I'm excited to talk to Donnie Fowler,
mm-hmm.
At what point do we redefine the Democrats by being who we are? And then by, you know, just like sticking by our values, not making compromises because we think we're going to lose Republicans?
Well, what they say in many instances is that you lose the all-important independent swing vote. But Donnie Fowler, Howard Dean, and see, it's interesting about Howard Dean because he's been, you know, the front runner before when he was running for president. I think that makes some people very hesitant to call him a front runner now. But there's some news that just came out as of yesterday's vote Association of State Democratic Chairs. We got to get to that.
Let's hit it right when we come back, Mark.
Yeah.
All right, 16 past the hour on Air America Radio.
Morning Tradition, delivering you from evil. In 3 hours or less, Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley there.
Hey!
What's going on, folks? It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Momentarily, in a few minutes, we'll be talking to DNC candidate Donnie Fowler. Right now, I'm going to do the Palm Pilot. This comes from Ramon, who is I don't know, despairing today, and I had no time to really talk to him. But here is George W. Bush's Palm Pilot for today, February 1st, 10 a.m. It's Black History Month. Ask Condi to round up some black people for photo op. Note, not Snoop Dogg or Michael Jackson, please. Here. 11, call Iyad Alawi. Tell him this is a time for unity in Iraq between your oil and our companies. How about that? Let's shake on it. Noon. Call Tony Blair. Ask, how's Iran in April sound to you? Good? Huh? Iran in April for a little thing? Huh? 2 p.m. Talk to AARP officials. Say this. My father is really old, and you don't hear him whining about Social Security. Huh? You don't hear the old man. 3:30. Accuse Hillary Clinton of dirty politics. Say this. You won't faint your way into the White House, lady. I know your guy got your number. 4:30, signed proclamation in honor of American Heart Month. Bring Cheney on stage for a peacemaker and peacemaker photo op. See, look, he's still alive. Look at him. He's still ticking. Huh? Look at, he's having a heart attack right now.
Oh, see.
There, he just had another one. He's got the special Cheney heart, too.
Ooh.
All right, dude. All right, so let's parse this thing. Riley.
All right.
Howard Dean. Definitely got a big endorsement. Tell me, you know, paint the picture before we bring Donnie Fowler out here about what makes this so exciting.
Okay.
Yeah.
447 members of the DNC will be voting February 12th to elect a new chair.
Mm-hmm.
A crucial component of that 447 is the Association of State Democratic Chairmen.
Right.
They voted over this past, or actually their executive committee at first voted to back Donnie Fowler.
Oh, yeah.
And the conventional wisdom was, after that happened, that the full association membership would, in fact, vote to back Donnie
Fowler. So the executive chairmanship voted to have him in.
The executive committee.
The executive committee. And they said, this is our guy. And the rest of them said, I don't know.
The full membership voted, and Donnie Fowler got 56 votes. Now, that is significant because the other six candidates combined only got 35.
So it looks like it's going to be Dean and Fowler, but Fowler might be a little peeved today.
Well, he might be a little peeved. He got 21 of those votes.
Uh-huh.
And Howard Dean's people said all along that they were concentrating on the full membership of the association.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a killer to Donnie Fowler's candidacy for DNC chair. Mm-hmm. He's quoted, and I'm sure we can ask him about this when he comes on, he's quoted as saying, well, he's going to wait for the 447 to vote, as well he should, because they're the ones that actually make the final decision. But if they track similar to what the association did, then Howard Dean will win on the first ballot, thereby cutting off the possibility that a consensus candidate might emerge if he doesn't win on the first ballot. This is done much in the way that old-time presidential nominations were done, where there was more than one ballot.
Okay.
You know, now in modern time or in more recent times, the nominees are already decided before they go to the convention.
Sure.
Back in the day, they used to have more than one ballot, and that's the way this situation works. If there's no majority out of that 447, then they would go back to a second ballot, and then maybe Donnie Fowler or Martin Frost or one of the other candidates might emerge, because then it would show that Dean had a weakness among the larger body of the DNC, and he might end up losing it that way. But the way it looks right now, he's going to win.
And Wellington Webb dropped out.
He dropped out and decided to back Howard Dean.
Well, see, I don't think, I think Dean's going to probably win this thing. What do you think, Riley?
The way it looks now, yeah.
Well, we're going to talk to, we can ask Donnie Fowler what he thinks. I mean, obviously he wants to win it, and I'd like to hear what he has to say about the differences between him and Dean. The other candidates, as he said, are Martin Frost, who's a former Texas congressman.
Yeah.
Simon Rosenberg, founder of the Centrist New Democratic Network. Now, here's the other thing about centrism. How can it exist? How can anybody say I'm more of a centrist? How can you say that when, like, you know, people have different feelings about different things? I mean, you can be a progressive person and be fiscally conservative. There's all these different issues. So someone's got to tell me, Donnie Fowler, for instance. Donnie Fowler has got to tell me that, you know, what exactly the Democratic Party stands for in his eyes. You know, because if you ask somebody, you know, the progressive issues that really have to deal with, the thing that always moved me, let's listen to James Forbes from the Riverside
Church
up in Harlem.
Absolutely.
We had
Forbes.
Him on the show, and I've always just loved this piece that he said about liberal values.
We better go into our values. And I don't mean two values.
Mm-hmm.
I mean the broad values upon which this nation was built. And that includes care for those who can't care for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
It means productivity based on regulations that are fair for all of the people. It is based on a global vision that we are the global leaders. What is our vision for the globe? And how do we manifest that in our own nation? And we're going to be discussing how do religious values stop destroying folks and actually build up community and get us ready for the mission that is ahead.
See, that he brings a religious element into it, but boy, sometimes, you know, when you have somebody who is a reasonable member of the clergy,
mm-hmm.
you know, speaking in a way that is not proselytizing, but speaking in a way that is comes from compassion and charity, it's very, you know, it's kind of moving to me.
Well, you know, it does get down to interpreting the scripture, some of the same scripture that the right cites. But it's interpreting it very, very differently, and that's what Dave Forbes does.
Right. Well, let's see what Donnie Fowler and how he interprets the Democratic Party's goals and their core values. After this, we will have Donnie Fowler, candidate for the DNC chair. You're listening to Air America Radio.
Tradition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Thirty-four past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley. There.
Hey.
It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. You know, since our president is openly operating in a different reality, we think it's important that Americans know what's happening in his alternate universe. Luckily, we have a staffer who lives in that world. So now on the phone, once again, is Planet Push correspondent Lawton Smalls. Good morning, Lawton.
Hey, good morning, Mark. God's had an election, but he's the only one on the ballot.
Freedom. Oh, good. Today, yes. Today we're going to talk about the elections in Iraq on Sunday.
Why not? Yeah. Isn't it great, Mark?
Uh-huh.
You know, thanks to President George W. Mandate Bush, I wouldn't be surprised if the Iraqis came home from the polls and they all found a brand new washer and dryer waiting at home for them in the home.
Yeah, yeah.
Washer and dryer.
Yeah, I'd be very surprised if that happened, Lawton.
You know what I heard?
What?
I heard in downtown Fallujah is going to get its own Costco.
Come on. A Costco? You're making it
up. And when the Iraqi people set their eyes on that, they're going to say, democracy hasn't just arrived, it's arrived in bulk.
No, they're not going to say that. Bulk. They're not going to say
that.
Look
at all these riches.
They're not going to say that, Lawton.
Well,
it's not going to happen.
All right, they're not going to say it in American. It'll still be in the silly gibberish language that they speak. But, you know, soon they'll be able to talk in a way regular folks can understand. You know, speaking of that, I'd like to say.
No, it's
I really would.
No, please. Not again.
If you insist.
Okay.
I'm proud to live in a free Iraq. It's become a Christian state.
Oh, no.
Take your hummus and falafel back. Big Mac sure tastes good.
Can we not do this?
And I gladly stand up next to you, but my legs were blown apart.
Oh, no.
So watch me crawl to the Baghdad Mall. God bless Iraq.
Oh, my God. It's horrendous. It's horrendous. Yeah, you ought to be crying. What's the matter?
It's all alive.
Yeah,
all
right.
I don't care about the Iraqis. Yeah. I just like to see.
Okay.
We made a mess over there.
Yeah.
I was just thinking sad.
Oh, yeah.
Here's the thing.
Okay.
I'm ashamed to be an American.
Oh.
We're greedy and we're dumb. We took your oil and we ate your cake and we didn't leave you a crumb.
Oh, there you go. Let it out, buddy. That's all right. That's all right. See that what's inside you?
Thanks for letting me see.
You bet, man.
You know, it's the only thing that really makes me happy.
Oh, I didn't really know that about you, Lon. That's okay, buddy.
Is it okay?
Yeah. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm proud to live in a free Iraq. Now that Osama's dead,
he's what? He's not.
I'm gonna get me a baseball cap. Take the towel off my head.
All right, That's it. You gotta go, Martin. You gotta go.
All right, God loves you. Deal with thank you, everybody.
God
loves you.
All right, get off. Unbelievable.
Wow.
Unbelievable. All right, on February 12th, the Democratic National Committee will choose their next chairman. Joining us by phone from New York. Is he in New York? I believe he is in New York. Yes. He's one of the candidates running for the DNC chairmanship. Please welcome Donnie Fowler. Good morning, Donnie Fowler.
Good morning. I'm all over the place, just like the Republicans.
Yeah.
Oh, good morning.
Well, someone's got to stay on him. So let me ask you something right out of the bat. Tell me, you know, a lot of talk, a lot of lip service has been paid to Democratic core values. Tell me what those are, Donnie.
Opportunity, access, getting a fair shake if you work hard and play by the rules, a strong family, a strong community.
What?
A strong country, too, and can you believe it? We believe that families are important.
Well, no, I know. Well, no one's against any of that stuff. But tell me a little bit about access and what does that mean and what does opportunity mean in specifics?
Yeah. Well, the I want to add one more thing. One is one key value of the Democratic Party is breaking down historical barriers that keep people from succeeding, historical and artificial barriers. If you look at the tradition of our country and the things that we value the most,
mm-hmm.
a democracy, you know, we eliminated slavery,
mm-hmm.
we gave women the right to vote,
mm-hmm.
we gave workers the right to organize, we eliminated Jim Crow segregation laws. Everybody who advocated those issues, those philosophies, at their time was considered a liberal or even a radical. And today we take those rights for granted. We say, of course women should vote. Of course women should have the right to vote.
Right.
But back then, that was a radical notion. So this notion that liberals or progressives are evil and bad and bringing us to the wrong place is just crazy. The Democratic Party embodies the traditions, the best traditions of our country.
Donnie Fowler, we saw a process over that got played out over the weekend and yesterday, where the executive committee of the state of the Association of State Democratic Chairmen voted in your favor, and then the full membership of the association voted for Howard Dean. How did that happen, and why do you think the state chairs bucked that recommendation?
Well, the truth is the state chairs voted for me and Howard Dean and none of the other candidates. The greatest thing about that decision by the state chairs and vice chairs was that they almost unanimously voted for change. They voted against folks who've made their careers in Washington. They voted against a class supported by the aristocracy of consultants in D.C. who keep making the same mistakes over and over, and we keep losing elections. So the greatest thing about what the state chairs and vice chairs did was that it's time for change.
Mm-hmm.
Just like my website, changetheparty.com.
All right. Now, the AFL-CIO and other unions are expected to endorse a DNC chair candidate today. Why do you think they should endorse you?
Because I've been working with them in the states. You know, 4 years ago, the National Democratic Party needed someone to help us raise money and catch up with the Republicans, and we did that with Terry McAuliffe and the help of the grassroots internet movement. The Democrats could match Republicans dollar for dollar for the first time in our history, but we still lost.
So
now what we got to do is we got to take the National Party and learn the good lessons of elected officials in the states and the strong state parties and the labor unions who are showing up sometimes when other Democrats don't show up.
What are some of your reaching out ideas?
We got to include them at the table.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, reaching out is really less about reaching out than inviting in. You know, African Americans, Latinos, women, labor unions, they need to be sitting at the table when decisions are made. What is our message going to be? How are we going to spend our money? What kind of strategy and tactics are we going to use to beat the Republicans?
Okay, let's answer two of those questions.
Yeah.
What is your message going to be? How are you going to spend the money?
Well, the first thing is that the Democrats need to stand up and fight back. You know, when the Republicans, George Bush's buddies, attacked Kerry on the Swift boat, Kerry sort of sat around and said, maybe I shouldn't say anything because it's not in the national press. Well, it was on the minds of every single voter in the country. So let's stand up and fight for what we believe in instead of just taking it. The second thing, how do we spend the money? You know, I think the National Party is the best place to raise the money. But I think the local folks are the best people to spend the money. So we got to set benchmarks for every state party. What kind of technology do you need? Communications program, staffing. And then the Democratic National Committee says, how do we help you get to those benchmarks? 2 years, 4 years, 6 years down the road? And that's the partnership that the National Party needs with the state parties.
Okay, so we're going to come back in a second. Donnie Fowler, candidate for the DNC chair, we're going to talk to you about Howard Dean. We're going to talk about your positions and a little bit more. I want to talk about the center, the mythical center, when we come back. 42 past the hour, Air America Radio.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blog. MorningSedition.com, Air America Radio.
Sound more screen.
All right, we're going to put this thing down. It's 46 past the hour. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Yes, it is.
On the phone is Democratic National Committee candidate Donnie Fowler. Donnie, now let me ask you about... Now, a lot of people have a problem with Dean because they say he's too extreme, he's too left, he's not willing to compromise. What about you in light of this stuff? I mean, you claim that the issue of moving left or right is a false choice. Why?
because we're a minority party. That, you know, these intellectuals that live in the, that sit around in the salons and cafes in Washington, think that they, we have a choice. The Democratic Party nationally is a minority party.
I didn't know there was bohemian politicians sitting in cafes.
Well,
in Washington.
You know, they're little, they're pretty little salons with political pictures all over the walls.
Uh huh.
I mean, I don't live there, but that's what they tell me.
Uh huh.
You know, these guys sit around and debate whether we can choose between base voters and swing voters, whether we can choose left or right. And I think they've forgotten. I mean, they're so out of touch to begin with. They keep, you know, they keep making the same mistakes over and over and saying, well, we can just do a little better. I mean, the truth is the Democratic Party can't afford to choose left or right. We're running out of voters. We need to embrace the old politics, but we also need to...
What does that mean?
It means we need to remember and honor and respect our most loyal voters, members of unions, gays and lesbians, African-Americans, pro-choice women, registered Democrats. We need to recognize that also we do a lot of things well in the Democratic Party. We had record turnout this year among loyal Democrats, but the Republicans still beat us in turnout. That's because there are fewer union members.
But let me ask you something, Donnie. I mean, you know, what you're saying about, you know, you're making these implications about intellectual activity in terms of, like, when you're talking about someone like Howard Dean, this is a guy that's pretty stubborn about, you know, about where he stands, and he's not willing to compromise on the object of reproductive freedom. He's not willing to make compromises to accommodate, you know, some of these people that I assume you're talking about.
I don't think moving left or right is a question of reproductive freedom. Look, if you ask Democrats around the country, what does the Democratic Party stand for? A lot of people have a problem answering that question. But if you ask Democrats, why are you a Democrat? Why are you a Democrat? That's a much easier question to answer. And no matter where you go in our party, left or right, center, moderate, conservative, liberal, whatever, Democrats, progressives, are going to answer the question, why are you a Democrat, the same way about 80% of the time. We agree with each other on about 80% of the issues, on about 80% of our core values, yet we like to run these circular firing squads to fight over the 20% we don't agree with. The problem is that the folks we really disagree with are the Republicans.
Yeah.
And in a time, it's a luxury to say, let's choose left or right, middle, center, whatever. If you're a practitioner, if you're someone who's actually had to be out there to manage and win campaigns, or if you're an elected official, you say, we need some people from our base vote. We need some people from our swing vote. Let's see how much we can add them up to get to 50% plus one. It's a luxury to sit around in the cafes and salons and say, left or right.
What does that mean?
Wait a minute. Donnie, I got to ask you something along those same lines. Because you've said in a lot of public statements that you want local party leaders to lead the national party.
You got it.
But yet, a couple of minutes ago, did I hear you wrong when you said you didn't think you wanted those same local people to spend the money or to determine where the money's spent? How do you reconcile that?
You actually heard exactly the opposite. I said the national party is the best place to raise the money, but local folks are the best people to spend it.
Oh, the local people are the best people.
Yeah, because they know what issues matter the most to people in their communities and their states. They know what accents to talk. If you notice, I don't have an accent. Y'all talk funny.
Mm-hmm.
If you notice, they know what accents to talk in. They know who their neighbors are. And the most effective way to persuade a voter whom to vote for and to go to the polls on election day are their neighbors, whether that's their minister, whether that's their union leader, whether that's the civic club president, whether that's their husband or wife. I mean, that's the most effective way. Local people know better. The more that I do campaigns, and I've worked on the ground in 14 different states during the last 20 years, Wyoming, Florida, Connecticut, New Hampshire, California, Mississippi, Alabama, you get the point. The more I do it, the more I realize that local people know better what issues work and how to talk to their neighbors.
But not the local people in cafes and salons.
Those are the ones in Washington. They like to sit around. They don't actually have to do the work of electing. They just do the thinking of electing.
All right, so I'm just trying to figure out, you know, who you're characterizing as these intellectuals. You're not talking about, you know, maybe somebody like myself who lives in New York City who spends a lot of time, you know, talking about politics. Are you just saying that? Because it seems to me that a lot of those people that are of that ilk or of the, you know, Starbucks generation or whoever you're characterizing these people as, that they need to be mobilized, and these are intelligent thinking people
And let me explain. I'm not saying they're bad people. What I'm saying is, if you live in Washington, D.C. long enough, you think the Washington Post is the newspaper that everybody reads, and you think politics is on everybody's mind every day of the week, and you think that people wake up on Sunday morning and they can't wait to turn on Meet the Press and see what Tim Russert has to say about the world. The truth is, on Sunday morning, most Americans are in church, or you know, they're recovering from Saturday night, or they're recovering from Saturday night while they're atoning for their sins in church. So the point is that if you live in Washington long enough, you lose a perspective on what really matters.
So you're just talking about people who are inside the Beltway, who you say are...
who make a living off of politics, and who are making millions of dollars off the party, by even though they're making the same mistakes over and over.
But by using the language of cafes, it's sort of a... I just wanted you to flesh out what you were saying. Go ahead, Riley.
Well, I'm curious, Donnie Fowler, you seem to be saying a lot of the same things that former Denver Mayor Wellington Webb was saying, yet he decided to drop out of the race and endorse Howard Dean. How come he didn't back you?
Well, let me tell you, grassroots and state parties are fashionable these days. 5 years ago, ask these guys what they were doing. They were buying TV commercials. They were elected officials, all of which are very important. They were raising money and giving it to candidates. But what the Democratic National Committee needs now is to build up state parties, to help the state parties get on a firm footing so we can compete.
But Wellington Webb was saying the same thing you're saying.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Everybody is saying the same thing now because it's fashionable to be grassroots. Grassroots is cool all of a sudden. But my point is what differentiates me is that I've been doing working with the parties. I've been working in the grassroots for nearly 20 years. And if you need somebody, if the National Party needs somebody to help build up the parties, to understand what state, county, and local parties need, then hire somebody who's been there. 4 years ago, the National Party needed someone to catch up fundraising. Terry McAuliffe was the right person at the right time. 4 years from now, the National Democratic Party may need someone else to do something different. But right now, everybody stay in grassroots, but ask them, have they been doing grassroots?
Donnie, how many black Democrats are supporting you at this point? I know that you spoke before Southern Black Democrats about a week or so ago, apparently connected well, according to some of the literature I've read, but it seems like the bulk of black Democrats have gotten behind Dean.
No, the bulk of black Democrats are split all over the place. I mean, you know, there's not a consensus.
So who you got?
You know, I've got lots of people. I've got only about a third of the DNC members have publicly committed. Only about a third. There's two-thirds. This election is so far from being over.
So who you got? I mean, you got somebody like John Conyers or Charles, a name that we would recognize?
Joe Reed in Alabama is helpful to me. There's many others. Jim Clyburn, who's the former Congressional Black Caucus chairman out of South Carolina.
He's backing you?
Yes.
Okay.
You know, Donnie,
this game of, like, naming your African-American or Asian-American supporter, I mean, this is silly. This election is between me and Howard Dean right now. We're the only people getting any votes.
All right, but you know what I'm hearing you do, we understand that, is that what I'm hearing is that you're playing on a little bit of that sort of blue state, red state stereotype thing.
I've got support. Yeah, that's what the other folks want to say. I've got support from every region of the country, from blue states and red states.
Okay. Yeah. So are you in this till the end?
Big states and small states. I'm in this to change the party. This isn't about me. This isn't about a single personality. This isn't about it's about changing the party and helping build the state and county parties back up.
But you're in until the final vote here.
I'm in it until I have a good feeling that the party's going to go in the right direction it needs to go in, away from Washington and back to the states.
All right, Donnie, thank you so much for talking to us.
Appreciate it.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Take care.
That was Donnie Fowler, DNC candidate.
He really
answered
your last question. I don't know. Maybe it's me, but he didn't say.
It's weird. I felt like I was chipping away at something. You know, I was trying to find a way in, and there were a couple of moments that we found a way in. But you know, it's interesting. He talks like Terry McAuliffe. And maybe it's all similar, but I don't get that feeling. You know, it's interesting when you feel like. I was getting a wave of information, but I wanted to hear the soul of the cat.
Okay, but now you heard him.
Yeah.
Still back Dean?
Yeah.
Okay.
You?
Just saying.
You don't know yet?
I don't know yet. No, actually, at this point, I don't know yet.
All right. There's our liberal agenda from the Streisand compound. Here are your marching orders for today. One, spin control. Hillary didn't faint. She was overcome with compassion. Two, hand these out to Democratic senators to use during tomorrow's State of the Union address. Duck calls, slide whistles, compressed air horns. Three, if someone praises the Iraqi election, say, yeah, we used to be excited about voting here, too. Four, bribe a presenter on Oscar night to open an envelope and say, and the winner should have been John Kerry. Who's with me, people? What do I got? Today's phrase, just drop it into conversation. At my house, every month is Black History Month, man. Wake up, sheeple. The man's got your keys. Come on, how clear does it have to be? What do we got tomorrow?
Well, we're going to talk about the State of the Union address, because I don't know if I'm going to be able to watch it, man. I mean, you know,
I'll tape it and then we'll watch it in the morning.
The guy bugs me, man. He bugs me. He really bugs me. But We're going to talk about them anyway.
Yeah.
All right?
Yeah,
we're going to talk about that and a whole heck of a lot more tomorrow here on Air America Radio. It's been fun, man.
All right, you too. Take it easy.